All right. Thanks for having me back so many years in a row to talk about various topics like this. I've actually been interested in having sex with monsters for quite a long time. Not just personally, but it's something I've been sort of looking at in my scholarly work and in my journalism for a while. A few years ago, I published a book about monsters in American pop culture, which mostly focused on how monsters were an aspect of our fears about the economy. But as I was researching it, I kept coming across all these great stories about fucking monsters as well. And in my job now, I run a blog called IO9, which is a science fiction and science blog. And so, of course, I have many opportunities to post not safe for work films about people having sex with monsters. And so what I want to do today is talk a little bit about the different ways in which we imagine having sex with monsters. So not just the monsters themselves, but really the sort of the stage on which we have that sex and the way we imagine having sex with monsters. So what I'm really going to be talking about, make these slides actually show up correctly.
Your projector's lost VGA sync. You have to turn it on and off. It's going to be horrible.
Can someone do that? Does anyone just reboot the projector? Because I'm gonna, I actually have quite a number of images that we might want to actually see. Sorry for the brief pause, you guys.
Let's try it. Is there a letter around?
Yeah, for sure. But the first thing you should do is try to change the resolution on your...
Let's see if that does it.
There you go.
So really what I'm talking about here isn't so much having sex with monsters per se, although of course we will be talking about having sex with monsters and dragons specifically later on, but actually the worlds in which we have sex with monsters and in the worlds where people imagine doing that. And I'm talking about this, I'm using the term world building, I'm talking about how world building itself is sexy. The term world building comes out of the science fiction world, probably in around the 1970s, people started using this term a lot, and it just refers to the act of building an imaginary world. So it could be something that we do now with video games, when you're building everything from the rules of the world to the way it looks, or it could be if you're writing literature, you know, if you're writing a giant fantasy novel and you're kind of coming up with like a million different species of creature, and like Lord of the Rings style, they each have their own languages and they have a long history and they have their own gods. All of that stuff that isn't like me shooting someone or me like chopping someone's head off with a sword, all the stuff around that, that is world building. And for a lot of people, that is very sexy. Just the act of creating an entire fantasy world. And it can also be very bare bones too. It doesn't have to be full on Lord of the Rings, like I invented six languages for elves kind of thing. I guess there's only really two elf languages, but the point is, it could be very bare bones. It could be like the Dracula story, which is actually, if you think about the original Dracula story, which is really quite fun to read, it's just pretty much England in, you know, 1898, and there's this guy who's a vampire who comes over from Transylvania, but everything is pretty much our world except there's a vampire, and the vampire is like eating cute girls and making them really sexy and stuff. But that's the only thing that's different. So the world building there is really just let's create reality with a vampire in it, which is something that we're going to talk about a little bit in a second. So what I want to talk about is, first of all, how world building is erotic. I think as a side note, I should point out that pornography itself is kind of an act of world building. Anytime you watch a porn film or read an erotic novel, you're entering into another world where I can just go ahead and have sex with anyone at any time, right? The mailman comes over, we have sex. The pool boy comes over, he whips out his cock, and he's like, hey, check it out. That is an alternate world. So, I mean, maybe for some of us it's our everyday life, but for most people that is an alternate world, and there is a lot of world building that goes into pornography that we don't really think about. But I'm not really going to be talking about the pornography alternate worlds. I'm really going to be talking about world building in kind of classic genre stories, in the horror genre, science fiction genre, and fantasy genre. And I'm going to go through a few examples from each of those genres and talk about how it is that those genres make possible extremely transgressive forms of sex, kinds of sex that are impossible for us in the world that we think of as reality, and kinds of sex that are not impossible because you know, there's laws against it or propriety forbids the pool boy from taking out his cock, but actually because they involve creatures that don't exist, they involve laws of physics that we don't have on this planet or in this part of the universe. So really, there's world building that goes on that permits kinds of sex and kinds of sexuality that are just simply impossible in our world. All right, so let's start out by talking about the horror genre and talking about some of the world building in the horror genre and the kinds of sex that makes possible. Again, for each of these genres, I'm going to be only talking about a tiny little slice of these genres. Okay, the horror genre is huge. There are a ton of sexual narratives that take place in dark gothic genres and all kinds of horror stories that I'm not even going to be able to touch on because that would be a whole other talk, and I hope we all get to talk about it afterward in discussion. For now, I'm just going to talk about a tiny subcategory of horror, which is called paranormal romance. It's a blend of horror and romance. You've probably seen it in the bookstore if you happen to go to your science fiction section, which I hope that you do, like pretty much every time you go to the bookstore. A lot of books these days are being marketed as paranormal romance that might 10 years ago have been just marketed as horror or marketed as kind of gothic. But basically, in order to talk about the world-building parameters of paranormal romance, I want to talk about True Blood because it's in many ways the archetypal version of the paranormal romance. And I'm mostly going to focus on what happens in the TV show, but this actually goes for the True Blood books as well. So here's how you build the world in paranormal romance. Basically, what you have is generally we're in the real world in some sense. It's not in an alternate reality. It's not in, you know, time long ago. You're in contemporary America, let's say, as you are in True Blood. But lurking beneath the civilized, democratic veneer of our everyday lives, there's this incredibly elaborate society of ancient tribes and monarchies that are all comprised of monsters. And some of them are vampires. Vampires are almost always represented as being part of some ancient monarchy, as they are in True Blood. In True Blood, the vampires have kings, and they have, you know, people who report to the kings, and then they have, like, a magister who was kind of sexually tortured to death recently in a recent episode, which is kind of awesome. And so there's this ancient monarchy that the vampires are part of. But there's also werewolves, there's fairies, sometimes called fae, there's shapeshifters, there's all manner of different kinds of monsters, and some of them, as I said, are associated with a more tribal society, and some are associated with monarchy. The point is that they're all from societies that have rules and mores that are historical, that are archaic. And so the idea is there's this kind of clash between the modern day characters and this world that's taking place in a kind of, you know, that has kings and queens and that has ancient blood feuds and that has characters who feel free, for example, to murder one another to exact revenge or to make a point. So it's a kind of an ancient world lurking beneath the modern world. And One of the characteristics of these ancient worlds, almost inevitably in paranormal romance, is that they are patriarchal. They're monarchies where, you know, men are often in charge, and women who are central to these stories are generally, as in the case of True Blood, there's a lot of discussion about who owns Sookie. Sookie is the main character. She's the one in here in the middle with all the blood on her, along with her two... the two men who argue over which of them possesses her. And this is a really big theme in True Blood, is who does Sookie belong to? And initially, Sookie belongs to Bill, the guy who's on the right there. I should just add that there's a version of this cover with just the two men kind of squashed up against each other, for those of you who wanted to have the gay version, but the classic hetero version is what we're looking at today. But Bill initially possesses Sookie, and he does that partly by having sex with her and being in love with her, but also by drinking her blood and by protecting her from everything, because she's constantly in danger because there's all these other monsters around, and also because her blood is super, super, super tasty. That's just one of the things that happens in these paranormal romances a lot of the times, that the main character's blood is just super tasty. And it comes up again, and I'm not kidding, it comes up again in Twilight, and we'll talk about that. Bella's blood in Twilight, ultra tasty. Everybody wants some. So Sookie's super tasty blood. So she's possessed by Bill, but Eric is jealous. And Eric is an older vampire who's actually technically in charge of Bill. So they have a lot of debates over who owns her and who gets to drink her blood. In this world of ancient rules and creatures who are otherworldly, who are often undead, who often possess, very supernatural powers, sex is inevitably connected with death and transgression of all different kinds. You can't have sex with a vampire without them biting you. That's just the way it is, okay? And it's actually quite hot. I mean, there's a number of great scenes where Sookie is having sex with Bill and he's biting her, and there's like blood and biting and penetration everywhere, and you're in the graveyard and you're covered in dirt. So there's all these images of transgression, like fucking in dirt, like being penetrated all over and bleeding. But at the same time, there's not just these actual images of transgressive sex, but they're taking place in this world with these old-fashioned rules, with these rules of monarchy, these rules of possession of women. So those two things kind of go hand in hand. And it's, as I was mentioning earlier, I think this is heightened even more in the Twilight series, which is a popular series of young adult novels which have been made into some films, with a similar kind of plot where the main character, Bella, is basically a human with extra tasty blood, a vampire named Edward, that's the two of them over there, Edward falls in love with her, and he then enters into a relationship with her where he possesses her, and she becomes his property, and he protects his ownership of her from the other vampires, who of course all also want to snack on her, and he follows her around, he keeps her from danger, but he also keeps her close to him by exerting this kind of erotic pull over her, and at the same time, he is so powerful that if she were to have sex with him, which she really doesn't get to do until the very end, if you've been watching the films, she still hasn't had sex with him yet, even though she's tried a whole bunch of times. You're not going to get to see that until the next two films. But if, and this is spoilers for those of you who haven't read the books, if she has sex with him, she will absolutely pass out because it is so intense, vampire sex, and she may die. And when she gets pregnant, automatic death. Total automatic death, because now she has this hybrid vampire baby that's like munching on her vulva from the inside. And actually, I talked to the woman who's writing the screenplay for for the film, and she said, I think we're going to leave out the scene where Edward actually bites into her vulva, because we didn't think we could show that on film. But he does have to kind of rescue her during this horrible childbirth scene. So again, there's these images of sexuality associated with death and transgression, but always these images of kind of restraint and women being held back. They're physical in the sense that they are physically being restrained and they're physically being violated, but at the same time, again, there's these social strictures that they're operating within, these kind of archaic monarchies. There's also an ancient vampire monarchy in Twilight. They're called the Volturi, and they have glowing red eyes, and they kind of intervene at various moments and cackle madly, and they are the most powerful of the vampires. So what happens in paranormal romance is that you build a world in which the most transgressive forms of sex in our human world are just normal for vampires and for changelings and for, I mean, that's not even getting into werewolves. that's not covered in today's lecture. So basically, it's a fantasy in which the world that these characters inhabit is a world of just constant sex that, like I said, that we would consider in our human world to be transgressive. It might be labeled BDSM. It might be considered even too transgressive for many BDSM spaces that don't allow bloodletting, for example. But totally normal. As I say in the slide, this is vanilla sex for vampires, tying the woman up, biting her. And this is actually a scene from, I think it's maybe even the first or second episode of True Blood. This is actually a vampire sex tape that's released. And one of the things that vampires can do, among many other things, is they can fuck really fast. And so when you see this image, he's fucking her in like CGI enhanced, like mega time. And she's like, whoa! So it's this very, very violent, intense, aggressive sex, but it's just normal. That's just how it is. And it's also just normal in our world for men to possess women. And so there you have this erotic world that's been built. All right. Let's talk about fantasy. So I want to talk specifically, I love this picture. I'll tell you in a minute what this picture is from. So basically, like horror, the fantasy genre has a number of world-building rules. And there's all kinds of fantasy stories. Again, I don't mean to talk about all of them at the same time, but for our purposes here, what I want to talk about is one type of fantasy world, which is the fantasy world in which people are going on a quest. It's very, very common in fantasy stories. For anyone who's read Lord of the Rings or watched the movies or played World of Warcraft, you know that central to the story, central to the world, is the idea that you're going on a quest. Another thing that's very central, and I think that this was interesting, we talked about it earlier in the Mass Effect talk, is that fantasy takes place not in our world the way paranormal romance does. Fantasy is almost always set in an alternate world. So it's either another planet, it's a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, it's an alternate history, perhaps, or just another world, Middle Earth. Who the fuck is Middle Earth? I don't know. It's not here, it's not on our planet. Maybe it is, but it's some alternate version of our planet. So it's really not, you're not even in the human world at all. There's no reference back to the human world. There might be human characters, but they're really not, they're not the dominant species usually. Although usually we're the main characters because we're human-centric. So what are the characteristics of the quest story and how does it lead to fucking? So the quest story is you're going on a quest to find something or get something or do something. One of the main rules of going on a quest is along the way, you have to complete certain tasks. If you don't complete those tasks, you will not succeed in your quest. A lot of the tasks will require you to solicit the aid of unknown creatures and unknown peoples, and to sort of succeed in your final goal. Now, what that means is, well, it's a perfect recipe for porn, right? Because A, you gotta do a bunch of stuff with a bunch of people you don't really know. But also, it's very much, all of these stories are an end justifies the means kind of story. Whatever you have to do to get to your goal, it's cool. As long as you complete your quest, meet the goal, slay the dragon, whatever, throw the ring in the fire, it's okay. Whatever you've done up to that point, however transgressive it is, did you kill your friends? Did you accidentally, poison a spider, which turned out to be really nice? It doesn't matter because in the end you succeeded. So you're able to have characters, again, who engage in transgressive or unusual acts as long as it helps them along their quest. So this, I love this image because it's actually, this is World of Warcraft porn, and basically, she's on a quest, she's wearing her armor, she has her sword, and as part of her quest, well, she has to masturbate in the field, and that's just the way it is. This is from baremaidens.com, by the way, if you want more of this. They've got a lot of free short YouTube videos on their site. They have some elf porn. It's pretty good stuff, and like I said, it's free. And so let me now sort of give you one really great example of how you get to fuck dragons in order to fulfill a quest in one of my favorite fantasy series. So there's a great fantasy series about fucking dragons by Jeanine Cross, which is called The Dragon Temple Saga. And this is, here you can see the cover of the first one, Touched by the Numb. You can see the cover is already suggesting there's this kind of erotic relationship between the woman and the dragon. The main character, Zark, of course, is extremely masculine, has a buzz cut, and is actually kind of a modeled, she's a person of color from her planet. But here, of course, as you can see, she's very feminine and white because it's the cover of a fantasy novel. But basically, sorry, I just had to throw that in there. But basically, here's the story. Zark is from a race of people who are basically slaves on a continent in this planet that's ruled by an evil king. And the way that the king exerts all his control over the people unfairly is by controlling the economy, which is run by dragons. Dragons are their main source of food and transportation. So he who controls the dragons controls the continent. So what she needs to do on her quest is she needs to become a dragon keeper and learn the secret of breeding the dragons so that she can help the poor slave people who live in farms and forests to get their own dragons so they can fight the evil king. So that's the quest. But how does she do that? Well, it turns out that in this fantasy world, dragons manufacture from their salivary glands a very potent poison which causes you to become high and also intensely horny. So there's a lot of, of course there's just a lot of gratuitous, like a lot of people are addicted to this drug in their world, and it's actually part of the dragon economy. But in order for her to figure out the secret of breeding dragons, she's taught by a secret group of dragon nuns that the only way she can do this is by allowing the dragon to plunge its poison-covered tongue deep into her pussy and fuck her with its tongue so that she can have visions and gain a psychic connection to the dragons, who then explain to her, in not so many words, how she can... what their life cycle really is and how they can be bred. I'll take questions at the end. dragon sex questions for later. So basically, this is part of her quest. She absolutely has to be repeatedly tongue-fucked by the dragon in order to learn what she needs to learn to liberate the slaves and take control of the means of dragon production. Literally. This is, in fact, about taking control of the means of dragon. And she does it, and it's actually an incredible story. And the dragon fucking is just one, you know, thing that she has to do along the way on her quest. But basically, this is a perfect example of a fantasy author creating this quest and creating a world where you absolutely must have sex with a dragon in order to free the slaves and overthrow the king. Now let's finish up by talking a little bit about science fiction. And again, science fiction is absolutely full of, you know, every kind of creature that you can have sex with. We already learned about all the aliens you can have sex with in Mass Effect earlier, which was extremely educational and helpful for me. But also, you can also have sex with robots, which I talked about a little bit last year at ours, so I don't think we need to go into that now. So I'm really going to focus on a very small, again, a small kind of sub-trend in science fiction, which involves having sex with aliens who are invading Earth or colonizing Earth in some way. Again, it's a very small subgenre, but it has a lot of examples and often involves a lot of kinds of sex. And it often involves mating between human and aliens. So I think probably most of you know the typical alien invasion scenario, so I don't need to go into it too much. But if you're doing world building for this, you're basically on Earth, aliens come, they try to take over. In this particular subgenre, they're going to take over by breeding with humans. So a really great example of this is the movie Slither. I have two stills from the film right here. Also the opening frame that I showed you with the guy who had the double penises coming out of his chest, that's also from Slither. It's a really great film. It was kind of it's kind of an indie film. It's very funny and gory. But basically what happens in Slither, aliens come down. They crash land in this suburb. This kind of annoying, blustery white guy stumbles upon the crashed aliens. They get into his body. Now he's infected with aliens. He goes off and has sex with a woman. Now she is full of his alienized sperm. And what happens to her is that she, now that she's full of the alien sperm, she blows up to this enormous size. You can see in the lower left here, this is her. She's pregnant with thousands and thousands of these red sperm-like worm things. So eventually, the nice sheriff finds her, played by Captain Tightpants from Firefly. He finds her, and she blows up, and then there's like red alien worms everywhere all over the town. And so then the good sheriff and his band of scoobies have to stop the squirming alien sperm before it's too late. But meanwhile, the dumb white guy who started the whole thing in the first place goes home to his wife. And by the way, that's one of the alien sperms trying to get inside somebody's body up there. He goes home to his wife, and there's actually a whole interesting subplot about how his relationship to his wife, he's a very dominating older man, and he's trying to control her, and he's trying to control her sexually, and now, of course, his sperm are, like, controlling the whole town sexually. And that's kind of a side note. But what ends up happening before the Scoobies eradicate the alien menace is that because of this scenario where the aliens are conquering humans through insemination, we gain access to a number of sexual images that are absolutely almost never represented in film, barely ever represented in porn. For example, men become pregnant because, you know, these sperm things, they don't care if you're male or female. I mean, they'll just come on right in and blow you up. So there's a lot of images. Eventually there's this kind of breeding farm in one of the farm basements, and all of these men from the town are these giant pregnant people who are eventually going to become that size. But before they become that size, there's tons of pregnant men, which is a big fetish on the internet. I don't know if you've heard of improv porn, but usually you don't see it represented on film. You also see images of bodies blowing up, people being having enforced oral sex with disembodied red penis things. You see a lot of women having intimate physical relations with monstrous tentacled creatures, which is sort of what the husbanded bumbling white guy turns into. And so basically, what this film has, you know, right before the end where everything's okay, is this kind of explosion of incredibly transgressive images of human bodies being penetrated and impregnated in ways that they can't be outside of this world that's been built. So I want to finish up with something slightly less disturbing than aliens who blow you up with their sperm. What you see here is an art project to represent an alien from Octavia Butler's series, which is sometimes called Xenogenesis and sometimes called Lilith's Brood. There's fans and audience. Octavia Butler wrote a trilogy, which is quite well known, and it's about what happens when humans have destroyed the planet. There's just a few of them left. There's been some kind of, we think it's possibly a nuclear Armageddon, but we don't really know. And this group of aliens come and rescue the remaining humans, because what they want to do is create human, the aliens are called the Onkali. The Onkali, who look like this, they're covered in tentacles. They want to crossbreed with the humans because that's how they reproduce, is they find new species and they merge with them genetically. They have three genders, and the third gender, the Uloi, can use its tentacles to connect to other, to connect to humans and give them these intense orgasmic experiences, which are also psychic, and then as that's happening, can harvest their DNA, synthesize the DNA, and then create a hybrid Onkali human child. So there's a number of extremely hot scenes where these Uloi have sex with humans, but the humans are not totally down with the program. I mean, it's a kind of a kinder, gentler version of what we see in Slither, where the sex is completely non-consensual in Slither. I mean, nobody wants the red sperm throat thing. And it's in the Xenogenesis series, the humans are seduced. I mean, these Uloi have these drugs that they can pump into the human body to make it feel really good and to make you feel like you've bonded, because there's this psychic component. But it's still coercive. I mean, it starts out very much coercive. The humans are say, you know, gee, we don't really know if we want to breed with you. You're kind of weird and tentacled, and it's not really what we were planning on. And you know, here we are trapped in your ship, and you're not letting us leave until we, you know, have babies with you. And so, however, we learn as the series goes on that the Onkali are, you know, ultimately better than humans. They don't have hierarchy, they don't have war, and they are turning humans into what I think Octavia Butler wants us to believe are better creatures in the end. So even though it's coercive, even though the sex at first is not desired, it ultimately creates a better species, and it's a species that ultimately will go to the stars. So they will eventually go onto a biological spaceship and travel through space, and which is a great goal of many of the characters in the book. So they're transformed in a good way through this world building, which nevertheless involves a lot of these coercive sexual scenes. So where I want to end up is by saying that really what's important about having sex with monsters isn't so much getting to have sex with tentacles or getting a dragon tongue thrust into your pussy or getting a vampire to bite you. It's really It's bigger than the monster itself. It's really about reimagining the world. This is about world building. It's about imagining a world where you can have whatever kind of relationship with that you want, whatever kind of sex that you want, wherever, with whoever, without judgment, where it will be normal, where you just do it because, well, God, you gotta have sex with the dragon or you can't complete the quest. And I think that's really the pleasure of world building, is imagining that space where you can do that and where it's necessary and beneficial. So that's where I want to end. Thanks.
Yes, it's me. Questions, statements, remarks?
So if it's not too much of a spoiler, you said that the only way to control the dragon economy is through this dragon-based penetration. Is it revealed whether the evil king engages in dragon penetration as well?
No, actually, it's something that only the women do. It's only the nuns know about it. And it's actually one of the things that we learn is that the king only knows one way to breed the dragons, which is to get them fighting, and it's not a very good way, and they don't have enough babies, and so actually the sex with dragons thing winds up creating healthier dragons, a better breeding system, and the dragons are happier. So she wins.
Hmm, as long as the dragons are happy, I'm happy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Annalise, since you brought up Octavia Butler at the end, I was wondering, since I'm sure you would be much more concise than I would be, if you could tell the audience a little bit about Fledgling, her alternative vampire novel.
Sure.
I was thinking about it in terms of the stuff that you're saying about the transgressiveness of vampire sex and how she made that even more transgressive in her novel.
She did. Fledgling is a standalone novel. It was going to be part of a trilogy, but unhappily Octavia Butler died very suddenly before completing it. But it's basically about the coming of age of a vampire who is, she's in her 50s, but she looks like a young child. She looks like she's about 8 or 9. And she is, by definition, polyamorous, because in order to survive, she has to have blood from humans. And the way that she does that without killing the humans is by having kind of, you know, 6 or 7 humans that she visits kind of on a rotating basis to take a little blood from each night. And she also gives them incredible pleasure while she's taking the blood from them. So it's similar to the Uloi, where there's this kind of non-sexual but sexual penetration. The way that the vampires live in her world is by forming these polyamorous families that they feed on. And of course, additionally, because this vampire looks like a child, it brings up all these issues around pedophilia, and she has to kind of retrain the human men that she's with to think that it's all right to have sex with a child because she's in fact much older than they are. But it's a very weird and interesting novel. I'd highly recommend it. Fledgling, one of the best vampire novels I've ever read. Definitely not paranormal romance.
Let's try this again. First of all, I'd like to make a plug for Xenophile, XXX Xenophile. I don't know if you've run into them, they're graphic novels. And xenophobes, of course, are afraid of strangers, and xenophile means love of strangers, and there's usually somewhere between 3 to 5 little stories where you have sex with robots, dragons, you know. It's all very humorous, but it's this incredibly, you know, well-rounded genre with a fair amount of gay sex and every other permutation. So I think xenophiles is a great little chuckle. The other thing I wanted to bring up was the movie, I think it's Teeth, is it? Or Dentition?
There's Teeth, which is about the woman who has the vagina dentata.
Right, that's the one I was thinking of. Which is kind of an interesting one because, I mean, she's a monster, and yet she's the victim. And these guys, by misbehaving, basically punish, you know. And it's also, of course, definitely not the traditional male patriarchal.
Yeah, she means to use her victimization as a form of power, which is actually a big theme in a lot of fantasy novels. If people have read Jacqueline Carey's series, the Kushiro series, which is about a masochist whose superpower is masochism, and her whole quest, she would never be able to complete it if she weren't able to endure hideous, torturous sex with a variety of bad guys. So.
There's this really pretty old Renga poem called The Princess Coming of Age. Have you heard about that one? It's crazy. It's like a really bad Renga poem where a princess kind of has to have, or I don't know, you never know, but she has sex with like four or five different like gnomes and plants and ceiling men, and it's quite interesting. The plant one is pretty good.
Is it part of a quest?
It's kind of a quest. Yeah, she tries to find her king. The new king, yeah, so, like, and she tries different species and what's nice and what not. The gnome, like, the dwarf is pretty okay because his testicles are bigger than himself, kind of. Like, it works kind of okay, yeah. Okay.
What do you think, there's kind of a lot of the UFO abduction accounts that you get from people, and I'm asking this on the assumption that they're not real, because I don't think they are. But based on what you're saying, why do you think it is that so many of those people who report being abducted by aliens report being like anally probed and raped by the aliens?
I think that's a really good question, and actually goes back to what I was saying about the alien invasion story being a world that permits the kinds of transgressive sex that we don't think of being able to do in our everyday lives. So I think it makes perfect sense that straight men who are abducted would fantasize about being anally raped by the alien, because that's a form of sex that most straight men are told is not appropriate and not accessible to them, even if it sounds like it might be really nice. But it's perfect, right? Because if the alien comes, you're under the alien's control, there's nothing you can do, so you gotta do it. So yeah, it's a perfect world.
Which means if more people would have anal sex and would be more commonly accepted, then they would dream of like super anal fisting or something like that.
Right, yeah, we would there'd be no more alien abductions, or we wouldn't need the aliens.
As long as I don't have sex with cactuses, I'm fine.
Carol, did you have a question?
No,
okay.
I'm
putting
my arms in the air.
Okay.
There's this thing that goes that our movie is really during different eras. It actually reflects the era that it's made. And so I'm wondering if the existence of the popularization of things like crew blood, does that say something about the accessibility or the idea of transgressive sex in under?
I think it does, yeah. I mean, I think those images that we see in True Blood that really are the result of the kind of suburbanization of BDSM, where people now are fairly comfortable with images of sex with handcuffs or sex with restraint. And so True Blood, of course, pushes the envelope further by having the bloodletting. And one memorable recent scene, there's a character who has sex with his hated ex-girlfriend, and as he's fucking her, he twists her head completely around. She's a vampire. So he twists her head completely around so that her head is now no longer facing him. So even though he's fucking her from the front, it's as if he's having anal sex with her because he's broken her neck and twisted it. And so, which is a much more extreme image than, say, a traditional kind of happy BDSM for mom and dad kind of image. But I think, thanks to places like Good Vibrations, mom and dad are having BDSM sex. thank you, Carol. but I think, you know, that the world building has to take it one step farther. So I think maybe 20 years ago you would have just gotten the handcuffs, and now you get the full throat twisting.
So now I do have a question, or a comment.
comment and then asking you to riff, I think. What that makes me think of is the fact that gay sex in True Blood is, in fact, I feel like I totally agree with what you said about the male control, but there's also there's one lesbian subplot with Queen Sophie and her person, who is, what, Sophie's cousin or some damn thing. But then there are the at least two gay subplots, not to mention all the sex with drugs ones with the vamp blood. And there's the king and the bad end that boyfriend came to, but he gets to be schlepped around in a jar, which reminds me of Vito Russo's insights a generation and a half ago about gays in the movies and how those have to come to a bad end. And what I think I really want to ask you is to riff on that, is sort of bring that up to date. But then there's Lafayette and Jesus, who
Jesus isn't.
Oh, you're rich.
Oh, damn!
She's like a boy.
Told you, there was a spoiler.
But for the moment, we're getting positive imagery. I like that.
Yes, we are getting positive imagery. Yes, please. I will digress. I think that you're right. I mean, there's a lot of. I think True Blood has more explicit gay sex and relationships than most other shows that I've seen. Just in the fact that many of the main characters are gay. It's also kind of taken for granted that a lot of the characters are bisexual. I mean, really, outside of Torchwood, I don't know of any other show that assumes that all of the main characters are bi. Torchwood is a British show that is a spinoff of Doctor Who. Literally, every character who's a main character is bisexual, and they all have sex with aliens a lot, or robots. And unfortunately, it's a bit of an uneven show, but I think that part of what you're seeing in True Blood is the same roles gay people are associated with, bad relationships, and they meet a terrible end, although straight people in True Blood also meet a terrible end. So, I mean, it's really a show that kind of hates all sexual relationships equally. I mean, all relationships are kind of terrible and dysfunctional and based on lies and abuse and control, non-consensual control. And so I think that actually I would go back to what you were asking earlier about, you know, as times change, what kinds of representations are permitted, what kinds of sexual representations are permitted. And I think because True Blood has done world building that allows for such extreme transgression in its sexual images, that it's then permitted to have a wide range of images of homosexuality, like fairly standard, just guys making out homosexuality, guys being in love and being married, and some BDSM that's fairly mild. And so I think that's part of the world building, is that when you have something where there's this extreme world, it permits these kinds of relationships that have been difficult to represent in mainstream television and mainstream science fiction and horror. So, yeah, but I think it's still, the gays on True Blood are not leading very happy lives, unfortunately.
I guess this is a question for also Johannes, but I was no. I mean, this is about the whole vampires and like the idea that vampires have these kind of ancient hierarchies and monarchies and you know, I was wondering like how I just sort of got this question of, you know, are we in America really obsessed with these sort of vampire sexy aristocracies because we don't really have that feudal legacy, and whether like is the perception of vampires different among Europeans?
I mean, you have feudal legacies and you have vampires, for example, the Bush clan.
I would agree with that. I think the reason why there's an obsession with this, in paranormal romance, the reason why you see again and again these monarchic and tribal cultures that exist right beneath the surface of our so-called liberal democratic cultures, because it's an effort to talk about the fact that all of that stuff does still exist in the United States. We do have a ruling class, even more so now, a tiny percentage of people who own the vast majority of wealth in this country. I think there's a good reason why True Blood is set in the South, because it's an area of this country that does have a long legacy of feudal relations between people who own plantations and slaves. And I think that the country is struggling with that, and that this is a way of building a world where we can actually talk about that, and it's permitted to talk about that. But of course, at the same time, because they're vampires and not people, it doesn't arouse as many fears, and it isn't as challenging to the audience as it would be to make a documentary saying Bush is really the king, his progeny are the aristocracy. We're not talking about Bush, we're just talking about vampires.
Yay! Finally!